expert in every realm.
Yeah, and they feel like they know everything, specifically the older generation. They feel like because they are experienced.
I don't agree. Don't bring the older generation into this. I have seen a lot of youngsters who talk about things without having read even some books, you know
but
what I mean?
Youngsters nowadays prefer to be quiet, I believe.
No, not all of them. Look through media and then you would understand how many
nice
of them are
silent. Nice example.
Silent.
I believe we have to discuss after a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So, welcome back to Youth Station. We were talking about not talking.
about silence. We're talking about silence, but talking is the way to explain silence.
Exactly.
That's a nice contradiction.
It is. And the point is, even in talking is a skill itself. And there is no doubt about
that. Of course.
That what a specific skill is talking, because most of the people think just knowing a language, knowing the different, for example, aspect of the literature of culture is enough in order to communicate with each other.
No. Discourse has got so much of, you know, things to learn about.
Exactly. By the way, I have to mention this point. You are an expertise here to talk about the literature and the connection between the culture, the religion, and all of these aspects towards this communication and talking.
Yeah, well, of course, culture is the background that through which language is going to be passed down to different generations.
Yeah.
Now, it might sound a little bit of illogical because language is the thing that creates everything.
Exactly.
But again, culture is the thing that is going to give meaning to your language, to the language of local people of the same era.
Yeah.
So culture, language, literature, religion, all of these things are interlaced to each other.
Exactly.
Like you cannot take one of them out and then set another aside.
Yeah.
All of them are intermingled. So when we talk about the language of a people, we're talking about their culture, we're talking about their religion, we're talking about every single thing that comes in the middle between these factors. But generally speaking, as for why we as human beings do not tend to stay silent, I would say that sometimes some people talk because they're lonely. And when they find two ears, like it's, you know, it's a chance.
Yeah.
It's a chance for you to pour everything out.
Yeah.
Like we all have seen those kind of people, like the grandparents. They're too lonesome when they are not having their children around them.
Yeah.
So what happens is that when the gatherings appear, when there is this weekend and everybody is around them, they just start telling you everything about their lives.
Yeah, like, I know.
Even their oldest memories would come to their mind and they would share it with you.
Yeah,
so
the most detailed material.
Yeah, so when you see some people talk too much, try to consider the fact that maybe they're alone. Maybe they don't have someone to, you know, a shoulder to cry on.
Yeah.
Maybe this is a call, a shout for, okay, consider me, I'm alone.
Yeah, there is a lot to say about this criteria of the need to talk to each other. But once I was really sad about something that happened to me. And I saw one of the old friends of the old time.
Yeah.
And it was quite by accident to see that friend at that day. And I wanted to talk. I wanted to tell her that, look, today I'm not feeling good and something really bad happened to me. I wanted to start talking, and she actually mentioned something which was beautiful, that I'm not your emotional wastebasket.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That for worship, throw it into your face.
Exactly. And suddenly I came to realize that, okay, she's right. I mean, she has the right to clarify this point.
So what friends are for?
You know, after a long time.
Come on, that way of looking at friendship is not a nice perspective.
It may not be the perspective of friends with each other, but I believe sometimes these people who are too much silent in communication, in a mutual communication with other people, are tolerating a lot, bearing a lot of burden on their shoulder. They are listening to the bad stories of every single one they're first facing in their life. They are listening to the miseries, to the tortures of other people. And at the same time, they don't have this opportunity and chance to talk about themselves.
In life, some people have got more inclination toward talking and some others have more inclination towards listening. Like, for example, maybe in some occasions I'd prefer to be a listener. But in some other occasions, I'd love to be the speaker.
Yeah, I get your point. It depends.
So, yeah, it depends.
And, by the way, you have 2 ears and 1 mouth.
Yeah, which
means that you have to more listen rather than talk to
exactly.
all of the people.
You have to practice listening more than speaking. Because those who talk to me, I always say to my friends, when there are misunderstanding happenings, I tell them that, see, that's the price you have to pay when you talk too much.
Yeah.
When you talk too much, inevitably, you are going to say something. But, it's your tongue. Something would slip away.
Yeah.
You are not so considerate about it. You're so headless. You do not mean it unconsciously.
Definitely.
Something would slip through that tongue. And then it would cut some people's emotion or, create some bad blood between people or do anything, because tongue is a tiny little thing. But it has got a lot of issues to create.
Yeah, most of the sins come from this little organ in our body. For example, lying, backbiting. And whenever you talk a lot, especially in a group of friends or something like that, something like backbiting happens a lot.
Backbiting, accusation of other people.
Exactly. Even lying.
Reproaching people. You would add, there are some spices that you would add to
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Like it's going to be close to a lie, to a gossip, to a scandal, to anything bad.
Yeah. And because of that, I believe we have to control this little muscular organ and we're going
to take us through a silence.
Yeah.
Welcome back. This is Youth Station, RIB English Radio. Bita and I are talking about silence.
Yeah. And we came to this point of all the harms of this little organ in our life and in our body, which is our tongue, like lying and backbiting and so on. And the very important point that you mentioned at the beginning of our episode was that you are hidden behind your tongue. You have to be very attentive about the way you are talking and the way and the times that you are silent.
So, your tongue is going to determine who you are.
Yeah.
The way you speak is going to tell people a lot about you. Your discourse, your choice of words
exactly.
is going to tell people who you are. There's a lot that a tongue can do for you. There's a lot that your discourse is going to show to people about you. You are hidden behind your words. Your words are going to determine your personality and your character to other people who do not know you.
Yeah.
So we must be very much careful about the kind of personality we are propagating, we are promoting to other people with the words we are just showing to them.
And we mostly talked about the skills that we have to develop in order to talk and in order to be silent. But from another hand, when you look at it, you feel like sometimes people, specifically more talkative people, are the ones that want to hide something from you. Hide the true personality of them, hide the hardships that they went through.
There's a void in themselves that they want to fill it with talking about many things. Just not talk about me.
And most of the time, this superficial knowledge will lead you to talk a lot about something.
That's why we mentioned the occasions that we have to keep silence. Like, for example, when we do not know something, we have to keep silent. Like, for example, when there is a bad blood between people, we have to remain silent. Like, when there is a gossip, there is a scandal going on, we have to cut it and stay silent. Like, when we know something, we're not sure about it, we have to keep silent. There are a lot of occasions to keep silent.
Yeah, there are. And the point is, as we mentioned, this talking itself is a skill. And when it is a skill, you may face, for example, some people that misuse and abuse this talking itself as a skill. Mm-hmm. They are so much skillful in talking that they may deceive you, they may lie to you, and you may not understand it.
Of course. Well, if we had more of time, we could have gone still like talking about how to keep silent, why to keep silent, and the values of silence.
There's a lot to say.
Time is flying so fast and we cannot grasp it anymore.
Yeah, for sure. There is no kind of specific conclusion towards this vast area of topic, but just consider it as a trigger for you in order to research more about talking.
Yeah, dig deeper in it.
And keeping silent most of the occasions of our time. But thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. It was all the time we had. I wish you for a ball. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings. Be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif, 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 Ya Latif.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will go over the blows the occupation army received in the Gaza Strip and the doubts spreading within the Zionist community about achieving the goals of the aggression. We will also talk about the absence of an effective strategy in Gaza or in southern Lebanon after Hezbollah was able to establish what the Hebrew media called a security belt inside the occupied Palestinian territories. Regarding these issues, I welcome Professor Hadi Kobayesi, director of the Union Center for Research and Development, with a warm welcome to you, dear professor. Now let us begin with the specific raid operation in the middle of the Gaza Strip, which is still a hot topic in the Hebrew media and within the Zionist community, and with words that came from the father of one of the officers who was killed in this operation, in which he described the leadership of the occupation army as stupid. This raid operation also affected the families of the dead officers and soldiers, including a brother of one of them. Israeli social media was filled with the comments of the Al-Magesi incident, holding the occupation leaders responsible for the killing of the Zionist soldiers and officers there.
Avir Nab.
The chief of staff is stupid.
Ravital.
The war is going on as if it were the first year of the chief of staff. I have always believed that the army is strong and the Jewish people are smart. It becomes clear to me every day that we are surrounded by fools.
Yali.
It seems to me that all our soldiers will be killed.
Dovdov.
Would it not eliminate Hamas and it not liberate the captives? This is a disdain for the soldiers.
Professor Hadi Kobayesi, to what extent can the leadership of the occupation army be described as stupid? And why is the confidence of the Zionist community declining, as we have seen on Israeli social media? This decline is also seen in the army's ability with its plan of aggression against the Gaza Strip.
We made many analyses about what happened on October 7th in the army headquarters in Al-Kiryah and in the areas surrounding the Gaza Strip. It was clear that there was a great shock, and the rush that occurred in taking Al-Gharawat was influenced by this shock. They wanted to restore the deterrence, prestige, and dignity of their army. It needed this. With experience, it has been shown that this decision, which was taken under pressure and was taken under shock, does not have the expected result or does not have a clear impact. Over time, it became clear how wrong this decision, which was made at the beginning, was. Biden referred to the experiences the U.S. government had in Iraq, Somalia, and Afghanistan, and said there may be a very distant success. Now it is being gradually revealed for society, and they are discovering the failure that has occurred following their so-called strategic decision. Expressing sentiments about inevitable victory for repeating such fake promises every day to motivate the society and the army to continue the war did not work anymore. Especially by Netanyahu and his team, who should bear the responsibility for what happened on October 7th. They said they were going in for a decisive victory, but things didn't work out as they thought. With time, these expectations and hopes declined, and we saw that within a week and 10 days, all the experts, commentators, and writers say that we have reached a point where there is uncertainty about the results. The other day, Amos Yadlin, who was a general in the Israeli Air Force, made an important speech. He said that the residents of the settlements in the area around the Gaza Strip must return because there are no longer risks to them. There are some voices that are trying to contain the situation and alleviate the crisis and are trying to solve the problem without continuing the war until the end, because the costs of continuing the war until the end are increasing, and it is increasing the number of deaths, pressure on the economy, international pressure. And now we have the decision of the International Court of Justice, and they are also trying to find a way out of this impasse.
As a result, Mr. Hadi Kobayashi, an army was established, and for this army, a regime was established. And now the Zionists in this regime doubt this army. How do you analyze this?
The army has been operating for many years, meaning from 1982 until now, meaning approximately more than 41 years, and it has not fought a large war. It needs new experiences, so they came to the experiment to see if they could succeed, but the experiment happened under pressure, without a clear plan. They discovered later that their intel about Gaza is not enough. Their intelligence system proved to be weak. The tunnels are a nightmare. Field operational information also does not provide results.
The resistance seems to know the tactics of the Israeli army.
The resistance is adapting, meaning it is learning from city to city, seeing how the enemy plans and how it operates. Also, the resistance has high flexibility in the field, as we see it is operating in Khan Yunis. The leadership is there, but we do not know where.
However, there's no real strategy in this battle that the occupation army is waging in the Gaza Strip. The question is, how long can the reserve soldiers bear with the losses they're incurring in terms of their lives and their economy? The absence of a practical strategy in this aggression against Gaza will inevitably lead to failure to achieve the two declared goals, which are liquidating the resistance and releasing the captives by force. The failure of this aggression on Gaza and the failure to achieve the declared goals prompted opposition leader Yair Lapid to admit that what he once called a superpower had received a blow from a resistance organization. So, Professor Hadi Kobayashi, while there is no clear strategy in this aggression against the Gaza Strip, how do you appreciate Lapid's description of the reality about their military failure in Gaza, saying that a superpower had received a blow from a resistance organization?
First, with regard to this strategy, it is based on two basic points: political legitimacy and capabilities and materials. In the past, there was always a problem that Israel has occupied a land that does not belong to it, and therefore this people are ready to fight for a long time. This is the problem of legitimacy. Capabilities have now changed, meaning that now they have no possibility to dry up capabilities or eliminate capabilities. Hamas, as a result of the presence of the tunnels, as a result of the smart, long, and careful preparation over many years for this war, has managed to adjust its resources and capabilities at the level of legitimacy. The people of the Gaza Strip want their land, and they are with the resistance and continue to support the resistance. Thus, the strategy, meaning basic capabilities and basic components, is missing at the tactical and operational levels as well. The resistance, as we said a while ago, is adapting, learning, and benefiting. It has gained a lot of experience in the past 3 months from the war. Previously, the Israelis were missing out on open areas. Today, they have open areas, obstacles, ambushes, and new methods of operation, even open areas. The resistance is back to work even in the areas that the enemy has destroyed, so there is a problem with continuity and reaching the goal. The areas that the enemy considers it is done with and destroyed and eliminated, what it calls the bridge capabilities, meaning the leadership and establishments, are back to work. The enemy also pointed out, and I expected it 2 months ago, that the youth of the Gaza Strip, who here have the ability to carry weapons, whom here do not have a job and have a very great motivation to defend, are joining Hamas. An Israeli commentator said that there is continuous enrollment in Hamas.
This confirms what the opposition leader Yair Lapid said in this context, that a superpower received a blow today from a resistance organization.
Of course, they were subjected to a very important strategic diversionary operation recorded in history. I mean, what Hamas did was very smart, and there was great confidence in it that it will succeed. What is more important than planning is that it has confidence in success, certainty in continuity, and preparation for the reaction as well. The enemy was not expecting that things would turn out like this. There is something in them that has a certain flaw. As we can see, all their previous statements talk about the threat to existence. 80 years have passed since the development of the axis of resistance and its missiles, but still Israel is not appreciating its enemy's capabilities. There is still disrespect, lack of appreciation, or belittlement.
It is clear that Israel's deterrence power has eroded, and there is no possibility of concluding this battle, neither in the Gaza Strip or even in southern Lebanon. And the coming days will be worse, according to one of the reserve generals in the occupation army. So we see that the occupation army is undergoing the worst erosion of its deterrence powers. We used to hear this from the Zionists before the Operation Al-Aqsa, and this confession is still on their lips today after the aggression. How will this be resolved? What does this confusion mean?
Of course, they always expected that one day the resistance axis would attack them, uniting the arenas, changing the balance of power and the permanent development that is working on the axis. We're now seeing the first stage of this uprising, and for these reasons, it was not clear to them how they would confront this operation of multiple arenas and multiple arms. They were counting on the United States of America, frankly, for something. Here is also an important factor other than the balance of power, which is the shock they received because of it. Of course, it is very important because they have become internally weakened and have lost vision and faith. According to what was leaked to the media, Netanyahu called Biden and said on the phone that if you do not come with your forces, you will wake up in the morning and you will not find Israel. This shock made the entire regime to think twice before making any move. For example, when it thinks about Lebanon, it imagines October 7th. When it thinks about Syria, that's the same. They always remember this shock. It is true that this shock gives them an incentive to work and also an impulse to aggression against Lebanon or Syria and others, but it also makes Israel think that, yes, I am heading towards a war, but I may receive an unexpected response too, and there may be consequences and surprises. Israel has become suspicious about the capabilities of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Also, Ben David said some time ago that we discovered that the capabilities are due to God's will, not ours to begin with.
As for southern Lebanon, the area that extends to the northern settlement near the border with southern Lebanon has enabled Hezbollah to impose what the Hebrew media called the security belt. The southern Lebanon front has inflicted a heavy impact on the settlers in the occupied Palestinian north and on their economy and livelihood, as 90% of them are experiencing economic damage as a result of Hezbollah strikes. Professor Hadi Kubayesi, it seems that the calamity of the South Lebanon front is very heavy on the settlers and their economy. To what extent does this represent pressure on the Zionist occupation regime and army?
We used to say that the war in Gaza is to liberate the Gaza Strip. I mean, after the operation on October 7th, the settlers living in the envelope emigrated. About 500,000 Israelis are trying to regain that area. Also in the Galilee, there are signs of Palestine liberation, but for a temporary period. I mean, we saw that the resistance entered the Gaza Strip for 3 days, but until now, the envelope is still unviable in the south, too. There are limited operations, but the strategic impact of these operations is very broad and very large, that we can see this effect on the return of the settlers or the perspective of this achievement. Israel has diminished. This is what we were talking about. Israel is now in need of a war to liberate the Galilee, even if it is not a large-scale war, because achieving security in the Galilee requires a different step, an adjustment in the balance of power, or a war that requires a new approach. They have now lost part of the land, and there we are at the first stage of the liberation of Palestine, an experiment or rehearsal, so to speak, which is taking place in the Gaza envelope or the Galilee. Exiting this stage for the Israelis is very costly. Either the settlers do not agree to live in the place from which they may be displaced later and may be exposed to another calamity such as October 7th, or they should acquiesce to a war that will displace them or destroy their settlements. Returning to the Galilee will take years. If they enter into a war with Lebanon, the return will take years. If they return after this war and say, we're ready to stay in an unsafe area, they will also have a different condition. Staying with a view to continuity in this land, searching for alternatives and preparing these alternatives in the future. I mean, the outside world will have a different situation.
No. It seems that the state of anxiety is expanding day after day in light of this missile, which we must comment on. Hezbollah targeted an intelligence facility site at Jalal Alam in southern Lebanon.
The process is simple.
And there's a camera, too.
But the importance of this process is the movement of the missile. This missile can cross over hills and valleys and target sensitive areas. We do not know how many ranges, because the ranges of these missiles used to be 10 kilometers, but there are also missiles with a range of 10 to 12 kilometers. This enables the resistance to carry out very important operations. And I'm not here to talk about options or possibilities. However, targeting sensitive points within the 10-kilometer line without having a direct view is an achievement. We see that the Meron base directly targets a high mountain with direct camera supervision over it, but not in the back areas, places inside the barracks in all fortified areas.
And then in surprise,
these are accessible with high precision and direct camera supervision.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Hadi Kobayesi, for your participation in this episode of Israel Watch, and thank you for your follow-up. Until we meet again, God willing.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails to our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, brothers and sisters of Islam all across the world. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani, an Islamic scholar and researcher of the Islamic House of Qom, is present in today's program to answer questions regarding Islamic beliefs. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, inshallah.
Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the authenticity of the book of the Quran. How much do you believe that this book that we have it today in our hands is intact? And is it true that the real Quran is in the hands of Imam Asr, which is the only authentic remnants of the proofs of Allah on earth? How do you answer these questions?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, we should know that when it comes to the alteration or deviation of the Quran or tahrif al-Quran, none of the Sunni and Shia scholars believe in this.
Okay.
They, all of them, are of the view that the Quran is not deviated, has not been altered during the history of Islam.
Or misinterpreted.
Misinterpretation, yes, is possible.
Yes.
But when it comes to tahrif, we have different kind of tahrif.
Distortion
or alteration.
Okay.
When it comes to alteration or distortion, we should clarify that we have different types of distortion. Let's see what kind of this distortion might happen in the Quran. First of all, distortion or alteration in the meaning of the ayat. You know, if you say that all the meanings or the translations or explanations of the ayat in the history, all of them are true explanations, true, let's say, translations, of course it's not true.
Yes.
It might have happened some misunderstanding or misconception of the ayat of the Holy Quran. It is possible that sometimes some of the ayat, some of the words of the Quran might have been misinterpreted, misunderstood, or wrongly explained or translated. It is possible. So if tahrif, if let's say alteration, means this, it might have happened in the Quran. There's no doubt about it. When it comes to tahrif in terms of the letters, can we say that some letters of the Quran might be omitted, or some might be added, some might have been changed? If it happened in a way that brought no change into the whole meaning of the ayat and verses, there's no problem with that. Sometimes, for example, some specific letters might be added or might be removed in a way that there is no...
Malik al-Yawmuddin or Malik al-Yawmuddin.
Yeah, both of them have the same meanings. Okay. So this kind of alteration might have been happened. Yes. There is no problem with that. When it comes to tahrif in the words of the Quran, it means that does some words added to the Quran,
or
is, for example,
changed
or omitted or replaced,
yes,
in the Quran.
Yes.
If it happened in a way that did not cause any change to the main message, to the main content of the ayat, then there is no, again, any problem,
yes,
with that. If this kind of change or alteration happened in the Quran, there is no problem with that. Even if you say that even some ayat of the Quran might have been omitted or might have been added in a way that brought no a kind of great change into,
yes,
the meaning and the content of the Quran, there's no problem in that. For example, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, according to some of the Sunni scholars, it's not part of the surahs, but some of the Shias believe, main Shia scholars believe, that this is part of the surahs.
Yes.
So then, since it bring no change in the whole message and the content of the surahs and the chapters,
okay,
there's no problem with that, either to believe that it is part of the surah or not part of the surah. But when it comes to, when it comes to this, that in addition to the Quran, it means that do we believe that some ayat, some words added to the Quran in a way that completely changed the meaning of the ayat, the message of the ayat, the content of the ayat? Of course, it never happened.
Yes.
This kind of tahrif is totally rejected by both Sunni and Shia scholars.
That's
or
right.
Tahrif in naqisa means omitting,
yes,
some part of the Quran,
yes,
some part of the ayat, some part of words of the Quran in a way that it changed the meaning of the ayat, it,
yes,
changed the message of the ayat, it changed totally the content of,
yes,
the ayat. Of course, this kind of tahrif never happened in the Quran.
If you see the Holy Quran in Surah Muzammil, ayat number 20, Allah Tabarak wa Ta'ala says, and recite as much as possible from the Quran. As much as possible. Rabbana, Rabbana.
That's why they say one of the beauties of the eloquence of the fasahat and balaghat of the Quran is that whenever you open the Quran, it's as if it speaks to you today very, very clearly.
The Quran is a covenant of God for His creature. It is misaq. It is covenant. for his servants. It is necessary for the Muslims to read this covenant and recite 50 words every day.
So what about the compilation? When I say compilation, I mean the collection of the Quran at the time of Prophet Muhammad. Was he himself the main supervisor on enlisting the surahs or the ayahs on that time? I mean, in an alphabetical order or topical order or the surahs or qawaid, something like that?
Yeah, there are different views among the Sunni and Shia scholars regarding the compilation of the Quran. The most well-known idea is this, that it is compiled by at the time of Uthman the Third Caliph. He burned the rest of the Qur'ans, Masahif, and collected this Qur'an under the supervision of the companions, including Imam Ali alayhi salatu wassalam. That is why, if we believe that this Qur'an is compiled by the third caliph under the supervision of all the great companions of the Prophet, including, for example, Amir al-Mu'mineen, then of course there would be no problem with this Qur'an. We can say that this is the exact Qur'an that was revealed to the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. But there is another idea. There are many ideas, we can mention just some of them. The other idea is this, that Quran was compiled, were arranged at least, we can say, by the Holy Prophet himself. Because of what? Because, for example, we have riwayat and a hadith that say the Prophet ﷺ himself says that the Surah Al-Fatiha should be Fatiha. Fatiha means the opener or the opening of the Quran. Since the Prophet himself named this surah as Surah Al-Fatiha, it means that it was put into the beginning of the Holy Quran by the Prophet himself. It means that the Prophet himself arranged the chapters of the Quran, that which surah should be first, which surah should be second, third, fourth, this way.
Okay.
And also, since the Quran was written by the companions under the supervision or observation of the Holy Prophet himself, it's really difficult to say that Quran was not compiled at the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But maybe different companions might have had some different, let's say, versions of the Quran.
Yes.
Then at the time of the third caliph, they tried to compile the Quran based on all those different versions in a way that should be very much close to the Quran which was revealed to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But for Shia, since it was under the observation and supervision of Amir al-Mu'mineen as well, then this is accepted that this Quran is the true Quran.
So there was no other volume of the Quran compiled under the direct supervision of Imam Ali alayhi salam?
It is said that there were Quran, but this Quran was not different totally from this Quran that now we have. In that Quran of Amir al-Mu'mineen, there were some explanations, some interpretations,
footnotes.
And sometimes, let's say, some kind of a specific explanation that made by the Holy Prophet himself, or when it comes to the occasion of the revelation, or let's say,
Sha'n al-Nuzul.
About Sha'n al-Nuzul, there were some beautiful ahadiths from the Holy Prophet, explanation from the Amir al-Mu'mineen. But the ayat, the wordings, the surahs, the chapters were the same. We cannot say that that Quran was totally different. If it were totally different, then it, Amir al-Mu'mineen had to explain that, express
That's right.
And A'imma had to reject that.
And let's get to the second part of the first question I posed at the beginning of the program. That is it true that the most authentic Quran is in the hands of Imam al-Mahdi?
Yeah, that is true, but it doesn't mean that that Quran is completely
so
other
Quran. So what does
Quran.
It mean when we say Imam As will come and he bring a Quran?
One of the point is that, you know, unfortunately, the point is that the Prophet ﷺ told the Ummah, his nation, that you have to follow Quran plus Ahlul Bayt.
Okay.
It means that Quran by itself without Ahlul Bayt could be misinterpreted, could be misused, could be misunderstood, misinterpreted, wrongly applied, wrongly used in your lives. So that is why you should read the Quran, you should understand the Quran with the Ahlul Bayt. Okay?
Okay.
So now, if we have Quran interpreted, explained, expressed by the people other than Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam.
Okay.
Then there's no problem with the text of the Quran.
Yes.
But the problem is with the explanations, with the interpretations, you know?
That's
with the expressions made by non-ma'soom.
This is the problem. So that's why...
Only a ma'soom or an infallible can interpret
best,
the verses of the Quran. Yeah, of and the most authentic person now on earth is Imam
Al-Asr. Imam Al-Asr, ruhuna fida, that he knows best.
Best.
That, for example, this ayah, what is the occasion of the revelation, Shana Nuzul? What is the meaning of these words? What is the main message? What is the, let's say, content of this chapter that should be conveyed?
That's right.
Yeah, what is the true understanding? What is the most true and authentic perception of the ayat? This is also very much significant, you know?
Okay.
That's why the way that Imam Al-Asr will explain the Quran, there would
might
be sometimes
be very much
something
different.
Different, yeah. But that is the most authentic one.
Okay.
That Imam, only the infallible Imam can present.
And what a beautiful chance it is
Of
tasting such the presence of Imam Al-Asr, listening to his speech regarding interpretation or explanation and description of the ayahs of the Quran. Because nowadays the Muslims, you know, by mere reading out the text, sometimes they might have a superficial understanding of the text of the Quran. Also, some exegesis or tafasir of the Quran are not authentic. But when an infallible Imam who has the Quran in heart, this is important, explains it to us on that time, how sweet the meaning and the connotations and the meanings of the Quran would be. Thank you very much, Sheikh, for your nice elaboration regarding this topic, the authenticity of the Quran, and what does it mean when we say the most authentic volume of the Quran is in the hands of Imam Asr. It was very kind of you.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstudio.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. We again do supplicate to Allah to hasten the reappearance of Imam Asr, Ajallallah, inshallah. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
Questions and answers.
an Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, who showers upon us countless blessings at every moment of our life. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. A warm greeting and peace to all of you, dear brothers and sisters, who are listening to this episode, and also a showing of our respect to the Imam of our time, Imam Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing, where we try to mention and tackle and address a lot of questions that you guys as parents might have with regards to your children. And specifically, we've been talking about teens. And the expert of our program for the past few programs have been Sayyid Salman Nagawi, who is a faculty member of Islamic Studies in Al-Mustafa International University. Let me say salam to him, and then we'll go to the topic. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much for accepting our invitation. So we've been talking about one crucial and like basic and fundamental issue, which is parenting styles. Previously, I've heard like there's helicopter parenting style, authoritative, authoritarian, but you've merged all of them in two styles, which is transformational and transactional. Somehow, transactional parenting involves helicopter parenting and authoritarian parenting. Now, in this episode, we would like to delve deep into the topic of transformational parenting and not transactional parenting, which we've already discussed. What points do we have to know? What are the qualities of transformational parents?
Yes, thank you. So we were talking about transactional parenting and transformational parenting. The problem with the transactional parenting was the child, which is brought up within in a constricted environment, he becomes submissive and he doesn't have an independent thought process. He doesn't make decisions based on his own understanding. He can't exercise his own judgment. He becomes dependent on his parents all the time, and when they're not there anymore, not there for him, then he always has a difficult situation to face in society.
Is it true that like parents who lack confidence and they haven't been seen in their like childhood and teenagehood, that they desire a lot of attention? This is how they try to prove that, hey, I'm your parent and I exist. You have to listen to me.
It's possible. It is basically because of our own deficiencies, the things that we lacked in our childhood and in our upbringing, the situations that we faced, and then again our parents faced, and then again. So it's a continuous thing. Unfortunately, we have to break that cycle. Somewhere we need to take care. And now we need to do it even more, because today, as you said before in the previous discussions, that the world is moving at a greater pace. We need our children to adapt to the changing environment. The need for that was not felt 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when we were growing up. It wasn't the same. Today, technology is outpacing everything. Values, ideology, principles, everything is being trampled upon.
Mm-hmm.
The pace of technological advancement is so great that you think of a bullet train and it's going at full speed and heading to a collision. It's heading towards a collision, and this is what we're being faced with.
That's totally right. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. Sayed was just mentioning the fact that we as parents are faced with the very quick speed and pace of information and changes of doctrines and ideas. And you know, everything is fluid these days. Your gender could be fluid. Your personality could be fluid. Nothing. I mean, you don't have any firm ground, any basis, any foundation that you could lay your feet upon and say, okay, I'm from here, I'm going to start doing this. There's always constant questioning of what is right and what is wrong. And the social media and, you know, the media itself is always bombarding you with the idea, questioning your beliefs, your lifestyle. So as a parent, you have a very difficult and strict responsibility these days. What should we do?
I'd like to indulge a little bit more into this point. It's a philosophical issue nowadays. One of the basic problems that we're facing in today's society as a whole, parents or otherwise, even scholars, of leaders, of religious leaders, those who want to take the society towards divinity, towards godliness, they're facing a great challenge today. When I say the pace of technology, science and technology is outpacing everything, values are being trampled upon, principles, there are no more, the questions are coming. The problem with this is that we have brought science at par with the Quran and religion. We're always saying science is doing this. What does religion say about that?
Exactly.
It should be the other way around. What does religion say about what should we be doing in science and technology? What does our values say? The problem even with many scholars, they think when we write a book or we write an article, religion and science, that's saying that religion is, science is at par with religion.
Yeah.
And this is a very basic philosophical issue which needs to be addressed, not in this session, but it is of a grave importance. So we need to, but we are faced with the reality. One of the problems is in transactional leadership or parenting, we're just, you know, we're sitting, as I said, on the bullet train. We have a myopic vision, we have a tunnel vision, and we're just being taken along without any control of our own. And we're going into for that collision. We need to create independent children who can adapt to this environment based on the principles and values that Islam wants to instill in them.
I think we need to raise and educate parents who know what exactly is right and wrong, and who know their value system.
Of course.
I mean, when you were talking, every adult, let alone teenagers and children, they are faced with to be or not to be, to be a woman or to be a man. The questions are always, you know, swimming around in their minds.
So because it's possible to change your gender so easily today.
Everything is possible.
So now, because it's possible, so it's within the realm of possibility, so therefore it can be done, it should be done. So, I mean, the problem, as I said, of course, science and technology is something we should realize the fact that it is something which God has created for us.
Right.
We need to harness the universe. God has created the universe for human beings.
Right.
For them to harness it.
Right.
And Allah Almighty says, I've created the universe for you. وَسَخَّرَ لَكُمْ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ جَمِيعًا مِّنْهُ. But I have created you for myself. وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. So we need to make our children realize, firstly, ourselves. There's a dichotomy, unfortunately.
Yeah.
There are certain things which we say we need to teach our children to be religious because we want their hereafter to be guaranteed. And we need to say, oh, study science and technology, you need to make your world. But Islam says this world is for the sake of the hereafter.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Let's go for a short break and we'll be right back.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. Sayed mentioned a very popular concern and issue that is going on in today's society. And that is that parents are so concerned about the material well-being of their children. This takes me to the hadith of the Noble Prophet that he said, I am so unhappy and discontent with the fathers of the end of time. And they said, because of unbelieving fathers? He said, no, believing fathers who don't care about the hereafter, about the eternal life of their children, and only engage their children in materialistic issues. And the other point, we say that we have to build this world. There are certain laws, material laws, but we seem to forget the root of all these regulations, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because this is what modernity took us to. It cut the root of divinity on the face of earth, and everything else started to float in the air. When you have no roots, you can go anywhere, right? So this is an issue that I think parents need to, you know, they have to have a very sound belief system of what, how the world is functioning these days, how different doctrines and isms are taking them to different uncertain aims and worlds that they're making.
Yes, very rightly said. So you have said, hit the nail on the head. Exactly, that is the problem. We need to take care of this fact that, look, today even as a religious scholar, a scholar of Islam, we are concerned with the fact that people should be praying and, you know, just divinity is limited and confined to the mosque.
Exactly. Secularism.
That is the dichotomy which we are, or ourselves are enforcing in society, because we want to maintain our hegemony of some of the space in this world. So we need to create something which we say we are concerned with this. No, as leaders of, we consider ourselves leaders of society, leading mankind towards Allah Almighty. The connection with divinity has to be established in all the realms of life, not just in the mosque, not just in the Husseiniya, not just in a fasting or on the, in the. That is one aspect of religion. That's not all. So we, as parents, as educators, as leaders, need to look at Islam in a comprehensive way. Science and technology should be at the service of mankind, for the sake of mankind, to establish the rule of Allah Almighty in this world, to develop this world in a way that that will lead to the dignity of mankind. All the time, mankind should be engaged in remembering Allah. وَلَا ذِكْرُ اللَّهِ أَكْبَرُ For the sake of Ridwanullah. That is where, whether it is managing our family, managing worldly affairs, economic affairs, political affairs, everything should be for that sake.
Yeah.
So this leadership role has to come into our children, and we need to become good guides and mentors and role models for them.
Exactly.
That is the most difficult part.
Of being a parent.
So it's not a very easy thing.
No, it's the most difficult task, I think. So just to wrap up today's program, listening to the words of Sayed, it took me to where modernism has taken us and led us to, a world where all our concern is about science and technology, a world deprived of God. And I think one of the reasons that people these days feel very lonely is because in the Islamic monotheistic perspective, every single individual is within a network, all, you know, with the head or with the peak of having the divine power. But now you're just little individuals floating in the air aimlessly just for, you know, this world. Thank you so much for being with us. Don't forget to write us an email if you have any questions at englishradio@irib.ir. And wa akhiru da'wana anil hamdu lillahi rabbil Alameen.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of first to six. My dad, who taught me the art of writing.
Listeners special.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam, dear listeners.